Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 404, titled Anglo-Saxonia versus Germania, a continuation of World War II. This is being recorded on March 23rd of 2003. Very quickly, there will be an article-length, detailed description of For the Record program 404 in the For the Record section of the Real Audio-equipped Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com within a week or so of the airing of this program. In turn, the For the Record section of the Spitfire website is linked to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU that offer the For the Record series on Real Audio. Recent programs streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older shows available for download only at a longer URL linked to both the For the Record section of the Spitfire website and to wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Note that you can reach Spitfire at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005, or email them at mail@spitfirelist.com. The Spitfire provides tapes or CDs to radio stations free of charge. Note, too, that For the Record 305 has a supplemented description for the material about the Bormann Organization. The meat of the vitally important book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, is now available in FTR 305 for distribution on the Internet. Also note the associated biography of Paul Manning, the heroic Paul Manning, about Paul Manning. Note also the fact that FTR 391 is a summary analysis of September 11th and related events, referring listeners to other broadcasts. So if you want to examine a summary account of FTR 390 of September 11th, the best source is the description for FTR 391 and the annotated broadcasts. Now, we were detailing in side one the use of proxy war by Germania, unquote, the Underground Reich. And in particular, we were talking about a very important arrest in Pakistan of Mr. Al-Hassawi, a key Saudi-born son of the elite and apparently a key September 11th Al-Qaeda financier. That was from Newsweek of March 24th, the week of March 24th of 2003. This detailed the recent arrest of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, which apparently was accomplished through the use of the vitally important Echelon network and associated Men with Hill station under attack by Germania slash the Underground Reich. By the midsummer of 1998, in my opinion, that clash over signals intelligence was part of the continuation of World War II and was the equivalent of an act of war, as discussed in Side A. Now, I suspect, this is conjecture, but I suspect that the arrest of Mr. Al-Hassawi in turn has led to a very interesting development vis-a-vis the 3/20/2002 Operation Green Quest raids. These raids were as a result of the heroic efforts of John Loftus, the former Justice Department investigator and professional military officer, whose work led to the uncovering of many Nazi war criminals in the U.S. intelligence system, author of The Ballara Secret, co-author of, among other titles, Unholy Trinity and the vitally important Secret War Against the Jews. His lawsuit against Sami Al-Arian, that is to say John Loftus's lawsuit, provided the documentation for the 3/20/2002 Operation Green Quest raids, which in turn led to the highest levels of the Republican Party, the Saudi elite, and to the Al-Taqwa network, the Islamo-fascist slash Muslim Brotherhood network that is at the core of many of the Islamist and Islamo-fascist organizations, including, apparently, Al-Qaeda, as well, by the way, as Hamas. The following is from the Wall Street Journal of Monday, March 17th of 2003. This article is by Glenn R. Simpson, who's been doing some fabulous work about Operation Green Quest and the terror trail, the terrorist money trail. This article is headlined U.S.-linked scholar to terror funding, Dateline Washington. It reads in part as follows. Federal prosecutors in Virginia have implicated a prominent U.S. Muslim religious scholar in possible involvement with terrorism funding. In a filing late Friday with the U.S. District Court for Eastern Virginia, prosecutors disclosed that one subject of their probe is also an unindicted co-conspirator in a separate terrorism investigation in Florida involving former University of South Florida professor Sami Al-Arian and his associates. A federal grand jury in Tampa, Florida, recently handed up a 50-count indictment that charges terrorism financing and racketeering against Mr. Al-Arian and seven associates accused of belonging to or supporting the terror group Palestinian Islamic Jihad. The unindicted co-conspirator isn't named in the new filing, but the Arian indictment and other records indicate the person is religious scholar Taha Alawani, a widely respected religious leader in the U.S. Muslim community. Mr. Alawani was recently featured in a one-page article in the Wall Street Journal for his role in training Muslim chaplains serving in the U.S. military and U.S. prisons, some of whom have been accused of spreading anti-Western Islamic theology. Mr. Alawani's home and offices were raided last year by federal anti-terrorism agents, but in a subsequent interview, he strongly denied any involvement in supporting terrorism. That, by the way, is the 320th Operation Green Quest raids from last year. Now, note the following. Note this complicated legal maneuvering. Skipping down. The new Justice Department filing proposes a partial unsealing of the search warrant affidavit at the behest of the news media. It states that the Arian probe in Florida, quote, was one of the investigations outside the Eastern District of Virginia described in the search warrant affidavit which we sought to safeguard by sealing the affidavit, unquote, U.S. Attorney Paul McNulty told the court. Now that Mr. Arian has been indicted, the secrecy is no longer necessary, Mr. McNulty said. Mr. McNulty's filing is also potentially subject to seal, but when it was filed shortly after the Alexandria, Virginia courthouse closed Friday, it was a public record. The filing also discloses a major twist in the legal battle over the search warrant. Note the following sentences. The subjects of the Northern Virginia probe, parenthetically the Operation Green Quest raids of 3/20/2002, continuing, a group of Muslim businessmen and political activists who constitute much of the cream of the U.S. Muslim political establishment long have sought to unseal the affidavit. But last week, they suddenly reversed themselves, and their attorney, Ms. Luke, asked the Fourth Circuit to keep the document sealed in its entirety. Why, I would ask. Perhaps there is some legal maneuvering here that I don't fully understand, but I strongly suspect that the reason is because they popped Mr. Al-Hassawi in Afghanistan, and the September 11th money trail is now beginning to lie open. Bear in mind that cream of the Muslim community in this country goes straight to the highest levels of the Bush administration or associated elements, such as Talat Otman, a director of Harkin Energy, to the Republican Party's ethnic outreach organization, to Grover Norquist, and bear in mind that Bush family associate Talat Otman of the BCCI milieu interceded on behalf of the targets of Operation Green Quest. And I strongly suspect that, in fact, if the true story about the 3/20/2002 Operation Green Quest raids were to become public, it would not only lead to George Bush's impeachment, but quite possibly his indictment and conviction for treason. Don't hold your breath, I would say, but it is very important indeed, and indeed I think that there is nothing more important on this earth right now than the 320th Green Quest raids and the subsequent investigations, and I think that is the key to removing George Bush, the point element, in my opinion, for the Bormann Organization of the Underground Reich, and in my considered opinion, a traitor. Short article from USA Today of February 21st of 2003. By the way, this was on page 4A, and it has a picture from CNN showing Professor Sami Al-Arian, and he's smiling there with George Bush. Article by Tony Losey of USA Today, headline, Professor was watched throughout the 1990s. Dateline Washington reads in part as follows, skipping down. Prosecutors in Tampa and Washington didn't see the combined evidence against Al-Arian from secret phone and facsimile wiretaps until last November. That's when a special appeals court gave the Justice Department approval to use the Patriot Act to its fullest extent. A U.S. official said Thursday that evidence gathered by intelligence and law enforcement agents was shared in, quote, dribs and drabs, unquote, after Congress passed the law in the fall of 2001, again quoting, but the spigot opened after the appeals court ruling, unquote, he said. The result is the most richly detailed indictment yet in the domestic war on terrorism, a possible harbinger of future cases against terrorists and their bankrollers. Again, consummately important lawsuit, the Al Arian lawsuit, and again on page 4A of the USA Today edition of 2/21/2003, you can see Sammy the Aryan, so to speak, and George Bush, good buddies, smiling on the same page. That should become an element in the 2004 campaign. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience. This also is from Newsweek, again, by the aforementioned Michael Isikoff, doing great work for Newsweek. Research credit on this to a member of the listening audience. This, by the way, can be obtained at the www.msnbc.com news site. This is our website, excuse me. This is titled, Hiding in Plain Sight. Did a Muslim professor use activism as a cloak for terror? This is from Newsweek's issue of 2/24/2003. Actually, it's from the March 3 issue. It reads in part as follows. For George W. Bush, it was just another campaign stop. But for Sami Al-Arian, a University of South Florida engineering professor, it was a golden opportunity. When Bush appeared at Tampa's Strawberry Festival in March of 2000, Al-Arian sidled up to the candidate and had his picture taken. Bush joked around with the professor's son, Abdullah, nicknaming the 6'3" teen, Big Dude. Al-Arian later told his friends he even used the occasion to press Bush on a key issue among Muslim Americans, the Justice Department's use of secret evidence to deport accused terrorists. In those pre-9/11 days, Bush was eagerly courting the growing Muslim vote and more than willing to listen to seemingly sincere activists like Al-Arian. When he debated Al Gore later in the year, Bush even made a point of bringing up the secret evidence issue. Al-Arian was thrilled and began registering local Muslims for the Republican Party and praising Bush at local mosques. "I think I personally played a big role in electing Bush," he boasted at a Muslim American dinner last April. Again, that from Newsweek of 3/3/2003. A picture of George Bush and Sammy the Aryan, as I jokingly refer to him, on page 4A of the USA Today edition of 2/21/2003. Now, I believe, as I've indicated in past broadcasts, 395 and 403 in particular, that a deal has been cut, and in exchange for covering up the Saudi connections to 9/11 and in exchange for perhaps giving the Saudis influence in post-war Iraq, with the continued marginalization of the Shia majority in Saudi in Iraq, of course, Saudi Arabia is Wahhabi Sunni. In turn, I suspect the U.S. is allowing Saudi Arabia is allowing the U.S. to use their bases. Saudi Arabia is pumping plenty of oil to avoid an economic repercussion from the Iraq war, and in turn, I suspect that a deal has been cut with Saudi Arabia, and that the Bush administration will cover up the Saudi links to September 11th, and in so doing, if they're successful, will cover up their own complicity and, frankly, treason in this context. September 11th is a complicated event. I would compare it with the German invasion of France in World War II. It was not a provocation, but it was known about in advance and was used by a structurally connected French elite to subvert French democracy and institute fascism. And I think that unless there is sufficient focus on what happened on September 11th, and unless Bush and company are removed from office, we are going to face a similar fate. I noted in For the Record 403 that there has been a lawsuit by Khalid bin Mahfouz, part of the Bush business milieu, which also involves Bush bin Laden family business connections. Khalid bin Mahfouz, a very prominent figure in Saudi Arabia, has filed a lawsuit against Jean-Charles Brisard, along with Guillaume Dasquet, the co-author of Forbidden Truth, and perhaps even more importantly, Jean-Charles Brisard is the advisor to the plaintiffs in the multi-billion dollar lawsuit against prominent elements of the Saudi elite for funding Al-Qaeda. Note in this context some information that has just come to light. The article that I read last week about the suit by Khalid bin Mahfouz against Jean-Charles Brisard was from the LA Times of 226 of 2003. Anyway, it's cited in the description for the broadcast. This is from the Wall Street Journal of March 18th of 2003. Once again, a big tip of the hat to Glenn R. Simpson of the Wall Street Journal, doing great work. Al-Qaeda list points to Saudi elite. Dateline Washington reads in part as follows. A cache of Al-Qaeda documents seized last year by U.S. agents in Bosnia identifies some of Saudi Arabia's richest and most influential families as among the first financial supporters of Osama bin Laden and shows how Al-Qaeda used charitable arms of the Saudi government. An account of the roots of Al-Qaeda found on a computer used by a suspected Al-Qaeda front group contains a 1988 memorandum listing 20 Saudi financial backers of Mr. bin Laden, the Golden Chain, unquote, as the bin Laden organization called it. The list includes the families of three billionaire Saudi banking magnates, several top industrialists, and at least one former government minister. The Golden Chain list, which doesn't indicate the size of the donations, was drawn up at a time when supporting the Afghan revolt against Soviet invaders, Mr. bin Laden's cause at the time, was a top U.S. foreign policy objective as well as a Saudi national cause with deep patriotic and religious overtones. The list doesn't show any continuing support for Al-Qaeda after the organization began targeting Americans, but a number of the Saudis on it have been under scrutiny by U.S. officials as to whether they have supported terrorism in recent years. The Golden Chain list was confirmed by U.S. officials and translated from Arabic by the Justice Department. It names billionaire bankers Saleh Kamel and Khalid bin Mahfouz, as well as the Al-Raji family, another banking family, and Mr. bin Laden's own brothers. A number of the Saudis on the list, including the bin Mahfouz, Al-Raji, and Kamel families, are among those under U.S. scrutiny. A bank controlled by the Al-Raji family is in litigation in the United Kingdom against the publisher of the Wall Street Journal Europe for an article that identified the bank as being monitored by Saudi banking authorities. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience, and a big tip of the hat to him. The following article from the web, and I'll give the full citation in the description, is by Daniel Hopsicker, the author of the book Barry and the Boys that I discussed briefly, and for the record, number 288. Just a small caveat, I want to note that some of the work that I've seen Daniel Hopsicker do has been accessed in by publications or in forums that I would consider to be less than totally credible. This is not to cast aspersions on Daniel Hopsicker or his work. If I didn't think this article was really important, I wouldn't be using it, but just that small caveat. This is from the Mad Cow Morning News website. It's by Daniel Hopsicker. It is titled 9/11, The German Connection. A year-long Mad Cow Morning News investigation has uncovered evidence that at least seven of Mohammed Atta's closest associates in Florida during the year leading up to the 9/11 attack were not Arab, but German. The names of the seven, all pilots, have not surfaced in any press accounts of Mohammed Atta's stay in the U.S., nor has their existence been mentioned or alluded to in official statements. Traveling with Atta, or meeting him around the state, Atta's German friends appeared to share a relationship with him of long standing, according to eyewitnesses, dating back to his days in Hamburg. The meetings, in places like Key West and Miami, were apparently very serious business. When they returned, said someone who was there, Atta and his German associates, quote, always came back glum, unquote. Only one of the seven is still in the U.S. Five live in Germany or Switzerland. The seventh, with whom Atta reportedly traveled extensively, has a criminal record in Germany and today lives in Saudi Arabia. The identities of the seven German nationals were pieced together from information gleaned in interviews with Atta's one-time American girlfriend, corroborated by independent aviation sources in Venice and Naples, Florida. And then Daniel Hopsicker compares the background of Atta's associates with that of Andreas Strassmeier of Oklahoma City bombing fame, whom we've spoken about in the past. He continues, Strassmeier's father was once a top aide to German Chancellor Helmut Kohl. Atta's German friends are all children of the German elite. Translation, possibly, Bormann organization. Continuing. But before delving further into Atta's German connections, there were two other related developments in Florida last week. In the first, the former owner of the Terror Flight School in Venice, Florida, Rudy Deckers, was arrested last week on a single count of felony fraud and booked into the Collier County Jail in Naples, Florida. As the Mad Cow Morning News has been reporting, suspicious and often illegal activities were commonplace occurrences at Deckers-owned flight schools at the same time the schools were training a veritable who's who of Hamburg cadre terrorists. Now the arrest of the controversial Dutch national comes amid indications from authorities that federal agencies involved in the 9/11 investigation are taking a closer look at Decker's business activities in Florida during the past decade, fueling speculation he might become the first non-Arab charged in a wider 9/11 conspiracy than has been so far revealed. Despite settling his lawsuit with former partner Wally Hilliard, Rudy Decker's legal woes may just be beginning, said state's attorney Jonathan Green. Posing for a new mugshot is the latest in a series of reversals suffered recently by the Venice Magic Dutch Boy, unquote, so-called because he is one of two Dutch nationals who owned flight schools at the Venice airport, which each, by apparent freak coincidence, ended up training terrorists to fly. By the way, the Netherlands, as I talked about in For the Record 370, Dutch Treat, was one of the epicenters of the Thyssen-Bornemisza Empire, along with Lugano, Switzerland. That empire binds the Bush and the Thyssen families through the Bormann organization. Continuing, Deckers also recently lost his battle for control of Huffman Aviation. Last week, its sale to new owners was ratified by the Venice City Council in a unanimous voice vote amid questions about who had been responsible for approving Decker's lease at the Venice airport in the first place. Then, too, Decker's helicopter crashed recently while he was en route to a showdown meeting with partner Wally Hilliard over control of Huffman Aviation. In another freak coincidence, owner of the second Dutch-owned flight school at the Venice airport, Arnie Kruithof, also suffered a near-fatal aviation mishap last summer when his plane fell from 100 feet in the air onto the runway of the Venice airport. It appears as if both would be well advised to stay away from open windows. The German element arrived in Florida with Wolfgang, unquote, in 1996. Prior to arriving in Naples, he was associated with an organization called the Flying Club of Munich, unquote. Wolfgang showed up from Munich in the mid-1990s and immediately began operating a flight school illegally in 96, stated an aviation source in Naples. Quote, he's half Swiss, half German, unquote. Wolfgang was instrumental in bringing another of Atta's German associates to Florida, a pilot named Stefan, who we were to learn has done jail time in Germany and was on parole there when he came to the U.S. and recently spent a year in Gündoğdu, Turkey. While regular German flight schools struggled to obtain the necessary visas, Wolfgang and Stefan apparently had inside connections which smoothed their progress. Sometimes it makes me mad that a criminal gets preference, unquote, said one German national flight instructor in Naples with obvious bitterness. Quote, Wolfgang signed off on Stefan's books, and Stefan also got in on a fraudulent business investor's visa, unquote. Wolfgang was in his 30s, said Amanda Keller, who lived with Atta during March and April of 2001. Again, quoting, he and Wolfgang were very tight. They went everywhere together. When he came into the picture, they were together all the time, unquote. Skipping down. Strangely, Keller also states that Atta always spoke German with Wolfgang, a statement contradicted by the testimony of Rudi Deckers, who told a congressional committee that when he addressed him in German, Atta had merely looked at him strangely. Less than 24 hours after the September 11th terrorist attacks, the world's eyes were riveted on Florida's Gulf Coast, where FBI agents swarmed the peaceful retirement community of Venice. Authorities said the tiny airport there had served as a secret terrorist training site, teaching three of the four pilots involved in the September 11th attack to fly. Since then, authorities have had strikingly little to say about Venice. Skipping down, speaking of an allegation by Senator Graham that September 11th attacks had been facilitated by a sovereign nation. We talked about that last week. Newsweek says its sources say the unnamed country is Saudi Arabia. That may prove to be at least partly correct. Still, there are few, if any, Saudis named Wolfgang. Indeed. And research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience. This is very ominous, particularly in light of what is to follow. This is a UPI story, Dateline Washington. Top White House anti-terror boss resigns. It reads in part, the top National Security Council official in the war on terror, by the way, this is Dateline March 19th, the top National Security official in the war on terror resigned this week for what an NSC spokesman said were personal reasons, but intelligence sources say the move reflects concern that the looming war with Iraq is hurting the fight against terrorism. Rand Beers would not comment for this article, but he and several sources close to him were emphatic that the resignation was not a protest against an invasion of Iraq. But the same sources and other current and former intelligence officials described a broad consensus in the anti-terrorism and intelligence community that an invasion of Iraq would divert critical resources from the war on terror. Beers has served as the NSC's senior director for counterterrorism only since August. The White House said Wednesday that he officially remains on the job and has yet to set a departure date. Again, I've suspected that in Anglo-Saxonia versus Germania, we are basically in Iraq falling into a booby trap. Again, it remains to be seen what takes place. Again, I think the dominant consideration is the underground Reich, and one must view that virtual state through a filter that will enable one to tune out the other spectra of light that obscure the truth. We're going to conclude with a short section from the book In the Name of Osama Bin Laden, Global Terrorism and the Bin Laden Brotherhood by Roland Jacquard, published in softcover by the Duke University Press and copyright 2002, about alleged al-Qaeda in Iraqi contacts, not about September 11th, but in about utilizing al-Qaeda as a backup to Saddam Hussein, both with links to the underground Reich. We read as follows. In 1998, after declining all offers that had come to them through diplomatic channels, those services are reported to have established a secret operational connection with bin Laden in Manila and Kashmir. It was indeed difficult for Iraq to ignore an Arab like Osama bin Laden who, quote, so effectively humiliated the Americans, unquote. Colonel Khairullah Al-Tikriti, brother of the head of the Mukhabarat, the intelligence services, is reported to have been named case officer for the connection. The arrest of two Moroccan associates of bin Laden in Rabat on November 11, 1998, made it possible to establish the existence of this link with certainty. According to Western sources, the Iraqi services have sought to secure the assistance of bin Laden's networks in case Iraq were again to be attacked by the United States in order to carry out attacks against American targets in Arab countries. According to Arab sources, in anticipation of a foreseeable reversal of alliances in Kabul, bin Laden had been in discreet contact since September of 2000 with associates of Uday Hussein, another of Saddam's sons. The ground for agreement was the anti-Israeli and anti-American battle. Bin Laden and the Iraqis are said to have exchanged information about chemical and biological weapons, despite the opposition of some of the Baghdad leadership. So again, are elements of Al-Qaeda, a backup unit for Saddam Hussein at one level and for the underground Reich. Note that two of the alleged contact points between these were in Manila, where there were Abu Sayyaf Edwin Angeli's links to the Oklahoma City bombing and first World Trade Center attack, and Kashmir, along the focal point of World Muslim Congress activity. That wraps up side two of For the Record program number 404, being recorded on March 23rd of 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.